Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, your butt at the party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur in the Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi. Joining me from, I'm going to say, almost halfway around the world, Double R, Azerbaijan. How far is that exactly as a crow flies from Brandon, Mississippi?
We've got 3G Wi-Fi out there in the blinds and in between volleys. I mapped it the other day, and maps on my iPhone said it was 6,800 miles from Brandon. We're a good ways over here.
Great minds think alike.
Yeah, it's a lick out here, man. And but I'll tell you, Jake. Now Jake's coming next week, and we're going to do a show that'll probably be out on the internet in a year or so. But Rocky, I'm going to tell you, it's what an incredible trip. But what an incredible week. I couldn't even remember when I called you a little while ago if we did a podcast last week or the week before. Because I have gone from mountain time, Mississippi time, to mountain time to, since the mid-January, I think I've been just rolling and going. And, but you reminded me that we did do a podcast last week, and man, you ought to hear about my week.
I want to hear about it, but let me ask you this. When you go halfway around the world like that, what is the recovery time for your body? And what I'm saying is adjusting to that time. Once you land, how many days does it take for your body? Okay, which maybe 12 hours difference, but it's time to go to bed.
No, I don't know. Probably for me a week or so before you really get adjusted. Ambien helps, you know. It take a little sleeping pill or a little melatonin as you need to, and exercise. Just get out and move around like you do when you duck hunt, like we are. And it is what it is. I don't know. When you go halfway across the world like this, Rocky, it I don't know that you do adjust, because we get up in the morning, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed at 3 o'clock in the morning here. We're 9 hours into the future from Mississippi, and we're going pretty good. But I tell you, we get back off the water about 1:30, 2 o'clock, eat lunch. It's pretty dang quiet around the house, but everybody's snoring, except for the snoring. Everybody's asleep. Once we skinned a few birds and done some stuff, it's nap time. Wake up about 7 p.m. Azerbaijan time. We eat dinner, just ate dinner about 9. Had some nice smoked fish tonight, and I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know that you do get adjusted, you know. And when you move so much like I do, look, Rocky, this is crazy. I had probably getting too old to be stacking these trips back to back. But I figure, you know, if I've got 48 hours, it gives me time to come home, wash clothes, and catch a minute, and move on down the road. And, boy, I was down in Mexico. We wrapped up with a nice trip there. Had a very, very nice season down in Mexico. And I was sitting in Hermosillo Airport, and I started getting texts from my travel agent, Cherie Bassam at All World Travel. Hope you make your flight. I don't know if you're going to make your connection to Dallas and yada, yada. Your flight's late. That's what I like about working with a pro like that is she's running ahead of the curve on me. You know what I'm saying? And long story short, I did miss my connection to going to Dallas. And I was supposed to get home at 10:30. On Friday night to leave to come to Azerbaijan on Sunday afternoon. And I missed that flight. So I'm sitting there in the Phoenix airport. Lady says, oh, it's no problem. I can get you home by noon tomorrow. I'm like, yeah, that's a problem. I thought real quick and said, can you get me to Memphis tonight? And she said, yes, yeah, I can. I said, what time does that flight get in? She goes, 11:30. I said, get me to Memphis and I'll be sleeping on my pillow 3 hours later. And so that was the plan. And well, guess what? That flight was late. So by the time I get to the car rental place, my car rental place has been locked up for 30 minutes. And I'm in Memphis, Tennessee. And Cooper and I just, we went and found us a bench in baggage and conked out with our stuff. And I was so tired. I just remember bits and pieces waking up, you know, when they were, I guess that's the night they decided to power polish the floors and baggage. And,
it woke me up. I would have come to pick you up. All you had to do was call me.
I'm probably all over social media, the sleeping guy with his dog in his lap at the Memphis airport. And, but anyway, so I got to the car rental place next morning. I was there when they opened up to go, boy, you're here bright and early. I said, yeah, I've been here since 12:30. But I was home and took a nap and, went and ate some boiled crawfish, got caught up, got packed. And, you know, Rocky, it's not the hunt. It's not the traveler being here. It's just the travel and the time zones and the grind. Leaving Mississippi to come here, it's 40 hours. I mean, you're in travel status for about 40, 41 hours. And that's a little bit of a grind. And, if you think about it, you know, just being in that airport, that airplane, and we flew Turkish Air over here. They had good rates and good connections, as best it could be. I'd never been through Istanbul, Turkey, and don't really want to go back through that airport. And last year I came over here through Doha, Qatar, and that was a trip. I mean, first off, you know, you're in the Arab Emirates, so it's just really, really nice facilities. But the craziest thing is I was going down one of those big long escalator sidewalks. The guy coming the other way was like a sheik wearing the white suit and the red checkered head thing, you know, and he had a peregrine falcon on his arm.
Gandhar Akbar. Mid-South wrestling. You remember him?
Yeah, exactly. And exactly what he looked like. And well, my host over here in Azerbaijan described him as a middle class sheik because he flew commercial. I got on my plane coming over here to Azerbaijan, and the whole back of the jet was full of middle class sheiks with their peregrine falcons, and that were coming here to hunt with falcons. Don't know what they're hunting, some kind of upland bird. But it's just a real interesting trip. Baku, which is the capital of Azerbaijan. First off, everybody says, where's Azerbaijan? I'm gonna tell you this story. You know
exactly what I was gonna get you to explain to the audience where Azerbaijan is.
Well, I had to look it up on a map. But let me tell you how I got to Azerbaijan. How does a Mississippi duck hunter end up in Azerbaijan? And you know, for years, we went to Russia and we do a capercaillie hunt over there. Not much of a duck hunting culture. Not much ducks in that place at the time anyway. And, but a lot of folks, you know, here, there, and yonder over the years have talked about the Volga River, the Volga River Delta that comes through Russia, you know, cause you're really, parts of Russia, you're really kind of encompassing the Asian or Eurasian continent now. So you're picking up a lot of, you know, common species over here that are very, very uncommon elsewhere. Well, you know, I had done a little research and legwork through some of the Russian associates about hunting the Volga River, and it's a migratory corridor. I learned it's a big like going to South Dakota. It's all about timing when the migration comes through. The peak migration is mid October, so you spend all that money, you go all that far. Even if you time it right, you're shooting some pretty cool species in mid October when they're pin feathered. What's the point? But I just kept thinking about it, and one day it just occurred to me, well, where the heck does the Volga River go? Well, it flows into the Caspian Sea. The Caspian Sea is it's fresh water. It's a little brinish, but it's essentially fresh water. And that's kind of how the quest when I looked at the Caspian Sea. Okay, here's where these birds are going. And I've got, remember the Maltons we talked about? I called them up and they said, yeah, we've been around Azerbaijan and, you know, and that's kind of where it all started was what led me down the path to come here. But be honest with you, as I'm talking to, I had to look it up on the map. Where the heck is Azerbaijan? It's north of Iran. It's east of Turkey. And it's bordered by the Caspian Sea. And it's south of Russia. And it's just tiny little town that I, tiny little country that I knew virtually nothing about. It's 94% Muslim. Which, you know, we'll talk about going to Pakistan one day. You want to talk about Muslim, I'll talk to you about Pakistan. But it's Muslim, but it's not. Because, you know, there's women and children, and they wear regular clothes, and the clients are drinking vodka that they buy at the grocery store. And that's the, Azerbaijan, I learned, was one of the first countries in this part of the world to extend voting rights to women back in 1918. That's not really kind of a Muslim trait. See what I'm saying? And so anyway, I think of them kind of like the backsliding Methodists of the Muslim world. But the coolest thing about where we're at, we're really about 2 hours from the Caspian Sea, but we're hunting in agricultural land. I can't remember the name of this.
What town are you close to 2 hours from? So you're 2 hours from Baku.
We're 2 hours from Baku, and we're in a little town even if I looked at southwest, we're 2 hours southwest of Baku. And Rocky, you know, my roots are in the Mississippi Delta. I was born and raised in Greenville. Part of the family lived over in Greenwood, which is the cotton capital of the world. I grew up seeing all the signs. The World Cotton Exchange was there. And right here coming in this little town, the big, big, huge sign that crosses the whole road in the curve like the arch that we drive under every morning. We drive under two big cotton bowls. And my host explained we have two sources of wealth in Azerbaijan. One is oil, because it is an oil country. It gained its independence from Russia in 1991. And Russia, it basically powered Russia through World War II because of its oil reserves. And the other source of great income is cotton. They produce a lot of cotton here. And it's just crazy to me to have come 6,800 miles from home to duck hunt. And essentially be sitting in the Azerbaijani equivalent of Greenwood, Mississippi. It's just a little farming town. And it's just built up around the farm. And, you know, the farm implement store, I didn't see a John Deere store, but it's different. So the thing that got me last year was when I realized we're literally hunting. We're hunting right now. The best I can tell through the interpretations and all is the wetland we're hunting is about 100 to 110,000 acres contiguous water body, and it's marsh, a lot of marsh grass. It's this vast swamp, but it functions a lot like an irrigation reservoir, and it's but we're hunting 8 miles from the Iranian border, and you know, look, I get phone calls from people like, is Mexico safe? You know, is Mazatlan okay? I live up here in Memphis, or I live here in Chicago. Is that okay? Man, you start talking about hunting 8 miles from Iran. You know, I grew up watching the news. I grew up during Jimmy Carter and Reagan and all that news. And the thing that just shocks me about being here, Rocky, is these people don't know or care. They love us. They absolutely love us, and they're just the people we're hunting with, and out in the country, they're just good, simple, poor country folks, and they don't watch CNN, they don't know or care, you know, they're out there tending their cows and their sheep and their goats and they're farming, and this lake we're hunting. One of the head guys here is a government administrator that's over. He's the best I can. I'd call him the area manager, the lake manager, kind of like a WMA manager back home, as best I can understand him. But the lake is divided into concessions of sorts, where like this group, they are the duck hunters on this part of it, and this group hold the concession, the duck hunting concession on the other. And Rocky, they aren't as sophisticated as we are. They don't have the name brands of guns and clothing and everything else. And I'll tell you that in greater detail in a minute. But they have got a duck hunting savvy and culture and history that stretches back before America was even invented. Coming into town, there's little, kind of like you see boiled peanuts being sold on the side of Highway 49. They're selling ducks. We get there at the lake in the morning and you hear shots. I'm talking pitch black dark morning and you hear shots. We're push polling in through, it'll take us, we've been push polling in for 35, 40 minutes and you hear shots, just one shot, boom, in all directions. And out there hunting. They're hunting. I mean, these guys hunt. They, you know, we're leaving here on March 10th when the official season ends. I imagine duck season around here is going to end when the duck migration has moved on through. That's just how they are. And I asked somebody one time, I said, you know, so they sell ducks here. And he goes, we've been selling ducks here for 2,000 years. And what blows my mind is there's no mud motors. There's no, we've got mechanical decoys over the last couple of years, plus what they've gotten from Europeans. We've got, you know, a dozen or so mojos. But the decoys are, except the ones we brought over last year and this year, are just, the cheapest, oldest, plastic, crunchiest, water-riddled, hand-painted a million time decoys you've ever seen. And they don't blow, they use electronic calls at times, but the people we're hunting with, those bird boys can't afford they can't afford stuff like that, you know. So the richer guys will, the owners will, stuff like that will, the manager will, they've got the money for it. But what just struck me this morning is, let me tell you about yesterday morning. So I came here last year and we hunted. Had a great time, loved it. I mean, I didn't like it. I loved it. I really loved being out there in just a real fundamental, hardcore hunt. And I've told people that have called about this hunt, this hunt isn't for everybody. This is an adventure hunt. This is an experience hunt. Yes, there are some interesting species, but if you want a vacation hunt, call me. I got Mexico. I got Argentina. This is a real hunter's hunt. This is a hunt. Play for keys, shoot straight, shoot far, because you're hunting a very highly pressured animal. The fact that we're decoying birds, it just blows my mind, because these Azerbaijani been out here hunting them since September. And I mean hunting them morning and night and every day in the same blinds, in the same setups, in the same duck holes. And you fall off where we've been hunting the part of the lake we've been hunting. We get up, we step off into this tiny little P-row and get everything squared away just right. And our guide stands up with a 10-foot piece of bamboo and starts to push pole us. And we're just going through a little rat maze of tall marsh grass. And that trail will open up into a little opening. And we'll go into another little narrow trail. And it'll open up to another. There's countless openings and duck holes. And they know just where they're going. They know this. They know this property is unbelievable. How many little trails are winding through there? You come to a fork in the road. Well, it forks in five different ways, and you know they know just where they're going. And so yesterday, I get in the blind with this guy. It wasn't the same guy I had last year. I loved the deal last year. This guy's a boy. You can tell he's a duck killer. He's a real strong personality. I mean, and it's cold here. It's, you know, the weather's like, feels like 37 degrees in the mornings, and it's windy, and you're on the water. This guy's got on something like blue jeans and rubber waders and a sweatshirt, a Walmart coat. That's it. And I've got on my clothes, and I'm glad I do. And all these guys are dressed like that at best. They don't have duck calls. They call with their mouth, and, you know, it sounds kind of funny sometimes, but it works. And so we get out to the blind, and I see where the blind's going to be, where we're going to kind of push the boat up into the reeds and get it wedged up in those reeds to stand. And I think we ought to move the decoys a little differently. He, no, 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 no. and we get in a boat, and it's like I realized today the guy woke up, it was raining, and it's like he woke up, instead of going duck hunting, or instead of sleeping in, because he done duck hunting, I mean, he had to take somebody out. He was in a bad mood. I could see that. And we didn't get along real good. I mean, it wasn't bad. It was just, it's just the guy, the only word I knew he knew was no, 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 no. And just a real strong person down. It's like he would touch me, poke me, here, that. It's a very humbling experience. Being, you know, I actually got explained to me yesterday morning the concept of a shotgun pattern opening up and spreading at a distance. I actually got explained to me the concept in Azerbaijan, the concept of leading a duck. And it was very difficult shooting yesterday because of the rain and the wind and everything else, but I hung in there. And this morning I had this discussion. I said, you know, I told my host, I said, you know, I know the guy's very skilled and knowledgeable, and I know, hey, I'm humble enough to admit, when I hunt with a market hunter, I could probably stand to learn a thing or two about duck hunting. And but you know, I don't need to be told all this stuff. All he needs to do is be quiet and help me spot ducks. And I would enjoy my hunt a little better if he did. And this morning, it's like, I can tell you, I hunted with the best duck guide I've ever met. He was quiet. The only thing he would say in a blind was Ramsey. He'd say Ramsey, and I'd look at him, and he's either pointing at ducks, or he was wanting to tell me something in hand signals. And we had a really good time this morning. And Rocky, how these guys hunt in the absence of all the modern day trappings of duck hunting is probably how they hunted 150 years ago. Heroes, battered up decoys, they scout, they know where they're going, they don't call, they don't move. That man, he's 54 years old, and he's got the eyesight of a 20-year-old, because he'll point, and I don't see the duck. I don't even remotely see the duck. The duck is a mile away. But if he sees that duck, he goes into game mode, because every duck he sees is a potential candidate for coming in those decoys. He crouches, he hides, he makes his calls if he's going to make his calls or whatever he's going to do. And it works. I don't even know the untold thousands of birds these guys kill over the course of a year, let alone lifetime. Now, his boss, I'd say his boss is 70 years old, but it's kind of hard to say. These guys smoke from daylight to dark all day, every day of their lives. Guy could be 65, he could be 90. I don't know. He looks old as dirt. And, he's a very interesting and very nice person. They're very poor and simple, but he's a very nice person. We talk at the boat ramp with hand signals and everything else. But these guys hunt pure and free. And what just I marvel at today is how, using just the absolute basics of duck hunting, they stick to the bare bone fundamentals. And we've talked about this, and a lot of your guests have talked about duck hunting. You know, so much of what we do in duck hunting is almost decorative or over the top. And you get to places like this and you realize that what it really boils down to is the absolute bare bones fundamental. Be quiet, be still, be hidden. Like it takes a little effort for him to get that P-Row and us backed up with a push pole into the grass like he wants it, to where it's locked in place to where when you stand up, it's solid. We're in 3 foot of water. But he'll do it, and we'll get to that last little bit, and I'll start to stand up and like, no, sit. Because he's not going to leave 6 inches of the point of that boat sticking out of that grass. It's going to be hidden, and it's going to be hidden perfectly every single time he backs in there. And that's just the biggest, and shooting-wise, they may be the best shots. I haven't seen this guy shoot, but I bet he's a good shot just because I watched the boss today. There were some upland birds we were driving out, and they got very excited. It was like a quail about a foot tall, and he got a shotgun loaded up, and that thing took off running like a barnyard chicken, and he just patiently walked, and when it flushed, I'd say it's about a 40-yard shot, and it didn't flush like a chicken might pop on a roost. That son of a gun took off like it'd been shot from a cannon. That man folded it, boom, with a barred gun, and you know, and it fell off in some real tall grass in a ditch. And I realized the way they started looking for it, we weren't going nowhere. We found that bird, so we all got in there trying to find that grouse or whatever it was. And they were proud, I mean, because it's got good white meat. And they love the ducks over here, man. They eat them as a part of their culture, it's a part of their fabric. And it's just such an amazing country to be over here with that kind of tradition and that kind of culture. And they are the hardest hunting duck hunters and some of the best duck hunters I've ever met in the world. It's incredible. And you know what I learned today, because we're here a month later than we were last year. Last year, the volume was better. We were shooting, in the high 20s, maybe, you know, sticking it out till 1 o'clock. And now we're shooting 10s, which is fine because it's not a volume hunt. It's not a, you know, we're here to shoot some kind of cool species, rare in the sense that they can only be found here in Eurasia or in this part of the world. Red-crested poachers, tufted ducks, Eurasian widgeons, which there's not as many of as there was last year, but we're getting Eurasian widgeons. We're shooting common shell ducks. The reason we came later this year is there's a little duck called a gargany, about a blue-winged teal-sized bird, absolutely gorgeous. And we didn't see any last year at the first week of February. So they explained to us that those birds migrate through very early, and in return, coming back through very late. A lot of them go down to India and way further south. And he said, you know, it kind of, the way he described the migration pattern to me, it sounded a lot like our blue-winged teal back home. So we decided to come later. They had a weaker migration than last year. They explained that, same as we did in the United States, the northern latitudes didn't freeze until very late. And the birds stuck it out further north up in Russia rather than come south, although they did get some birds. And but we are seeing the gargany, just like they said, the gargany are coming through. So that, you know, we're shooting mallards and gadwalls and Eurasian green wings, Eurasian widgeons. We've shot all the species we shot last year, but this year we're shooting gargany. They're coming through good. And I've got some clients coming in next week. That's the only reason they're coming, to shoot this little gargany bird, this little gargany duck. And they're a cool little teal. And but it's one thing I realized today is it was 12:30. I was getting a little hungry. And I kind of indicated to him, hey, I want to go to boat ramp. And, man, that guy was just, said, okay, you know, okay, but we can wait. I mean, they have patience. That's what I've been kind of beating around the bushes for, to say the one habit they have that I find myself lacking in a lot of times, that I see a lot of in younger people that I see myself, but I would also see a little bit of temperament maybe on social media. I think we modern hunters, contemporary hunters, we lack patience. Sometimes the ducks don't fly till later. And sometimes it's worth the wait, because that next bird may be that gargany or that red-crested poacher that you traveled halfway across the world to shoot. Then why not wait a couple of more hours? You're here. It's the most beautiful wetland I've ever been in, Rocky. It's one of the duckiest places I've ever seen. It's just tall marsh grass, just all these potholes and trails, and there's some open water, and there's food. It's an incredible resource.
I saw video, I guess, of y'all push pulling in, and it is, and then some pictures after the hunt. It's pretty cool looking place.
Yep. I really enjoyed this hunt. It's just, you know, I've said this before. I love the duck hunt. But the older I get, it's really transitioned more to the more a collector of experiences, more an observer of the process. You know, hunting with a guy that, as far as I know, his only skill set is duck hunting. It's all he's done in maybe his whole life. And his great uncle, the old man, who has probably been duck hunting since he was a boy. You know, these guys are duck hunters. And the greatest I've ever seen, and they're patient and they're hard working, and they live in that land, and it's just utterly amazing. I'll tell you something funny. My guide yesterday, and what was explained to me, this is something I didn't explain about, you know, being kind of humbled by his personality yesterday, his very instructional personality. What was explained to me was, we're the only American clients these people have ever seen. They're used to taking people from Kuwaiti that are really just here to vacation to maybe go shoot a few ducks, or from Arab Emirate, which really aren't shotgunners, a few Italians, but mostly Kuwaiti type stuff. And what my host was explaining to me, he goes, Ramby, you know, he doesn't realize y'all are duck hunters. He just last week he had some Kuwaitis that maybe had never shot a shotgun in their life. And so maybe he was just a little raw from that experience. And but last year we were here, and leading up to our initial visit last year, I had a lot of discussions, a lot of discussions online and everything, or on email with people that are in preparation to trip. And he kept talking about, you know, the professional Italian hunters and the professional French hunters, and that's just the word they use, professional, for good, you know, or good. And so we showed up, and this hunt doesn't attract sports. It doesn't attract recreational observers. I mean, these are people that the hunters that are coming here are duck hunters, real duck hunters in a good sense back home. And so we showed up, and we hunted hard, and we shot well, and we brought decoys, we brought our calls. Mallards work over here just like they do back home, and we brought our calls, and we brought our game, and one of the greatest compliments I have ever received, and it wasn't directed at me, it was directed to us, the team. Elchin is the head guy's name, came by the house. He's the lake manager. It's his name, and he came by the house that night. He comes by every night at dinner time just to visit. Very, very nice guy. And he told us, he said, I've had Italians and I've had French, and you know, we Azerbaijanis are very good duck hunters, but if all Americans duck hunt like y'all do, y'all are the greatest duck hunting country on earth, because we've never had as professional a team in our town as y'all. And he kept calling us professionals, because, you know, just because of the way we hunted. And that was a very big compliment. And today, it was explained, I think, because one of the boys I hunted with, our guys acted similarly. We were kind of hunting in the same little part of the marsh. And we talked about it on the way back. We said, you know, yesterday this guy was kind of rude, kind of insulting, however you want to call it, kind of humbling, you know. This morning, extremely professional. And once he just kind of, you know, got quiet and would sit down and do his part, let me do my part. Heck, Rocky, it worked good. We did very well. I knocked down one duck today. I thought they were going to, it was shovelers, and they were coming up the bank kind of into the wind. And for whatever reason, they cut out across the duck cone. I realized it wasn't no calling them in or back. They were gone. So I grabbed one on the back end, picked out a drake, and shot him, and he fell out there about 75 yards. Ramis is his name, R-A-M-I-S, Ramis. He looked at the duck, looked at me, and he gave me a thumbs up. And we got along just fine the rest of the day. And we had a good time today, and I'm looking forward to hunting with him tomorrow. But it's just... I find myself, the older I get, the process of it all, how different people hunt around the world, and why they hunt, and just the whole how part of it. You know, I think if you know, oh boy, we're all experts, you know, but we really aren't. You know, if a guy can just humble himself, no matter how much you've done or how much you've seen or how good a caller you are, how good a shot or how good a hunter or where you hunt, if you can just, you know, observe a little bit. You know, the great thing about duck hunting is there's more than one way to skin a cat. I mean, you know, you can learn something from practically everybody. You know, especially when you start getting around guys like this, they'll boy, they'll open up your eyes and teach you something about, you know, patience. And I'll say this to the day I die, it all duck hunting is or it's not, the art and the science, it really goes back to the fundamentals. Just absolutely set your decoys well, set your decoys where the ducks want to be, and play the game. Be hidden, not halfway hidden, not comfortable. Be hidden, and don't you know, play for keeps, man. Treat every duck you see like a potential candidate. Play the game, and when it comes down to it, they're not all gonna be 10 yards on the deck with their feet touching the water. They're just not gonna be that way. Maybe mallards in certain situations, but that's not gonna be it. If you're gonna shoot ducks, sometimes you gotta just make the shot. You gotta pull a rabbit out of the hat and make it happen. And that's just what intrigues me. You know, the first time I saw a red crested poacher last year, and this is what I get when you start putting the pieces of the world together. The red crested poacher, every time I post that picture on the internet, it blows up on Instagram. It just because it's a striking bird. It's a kind of a black body. The gray's got kind of a black body and a tennis ball shaped head that is the color of a orange, and just a Revlon lipstick red beak. Very, very striking bird. It's one of my unicorn species. Don't ask. I read too many bird books or something. It's just one of them species. It and barheaded goose I want to scratch off my list. And we came here. We'd heard they were here. We were hunting, and I shot some green wings and shot some widgeons and shot some different birds. And out of nowhere, I heard that. It's like just the air was just ripping like paper. Just ripping in half divers. And those birds came right over the freaking out there about 70, 80 yards. And the minute I saw them, I couldn't see the orange because of the lighting, but I knew what they were. And I grabbed my call, just like a rosy bill, just like a poacher, just like a scalp, just like a tufted duck, just like any diver you're going to growl at. But what struck me is at a glance, first thing I saw was this black body with these white wing stripes going down it, just like a rosy bill poachered. Exactly. That's the first thing my mind saw was rosy bill poachered. And without thinking, I grabbed my collar and started growling into it like I would a rosy bill. And those sons of a guns turned on a dime and came right low over the decoys. And it close enough that I could boom, 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 start shooting the black ones. And for the next week, a deal, my bird boy, he wouldn't say whatever the name was in Azerbaijan for a crested poacher. He'd go, he'd start growling, telling me to grab that collar and start calling. And so, you know, that's the process. See, it ain't, my clients, they like species. I like species, but I like where those species take me in a process of just duck hunting, not just duck hunting mallards or just duck hunting wood ducks, which trust you me, I love mallards and wood ducks. But just this process, this pure, big global truth of duck hunting. That's what just Rock. I can't articulate no better than that. That's what leads a guy from Mississippi 6 to 800 miles away to Azerbaijan. And it's an incredible country.
Let me ask you this. You know, we've spent some time on where it is, the ducks that you're killing. But I got to ask you this. If you went to any college, you had to take Western Civ, pretty much required for anything. If you went to school, I guess, late 80s and after. You had to have Western Civ 1, I remember. But if you remember what you learned in your history books, gosh, man, and I talked to you about this last week off the air, man, that's where the world began. All of the history in that little circumference out to Turkey, Iran, Iraq, man, everything.
Yeah. Egypt, northern Egypt, really, right here.
Yeah,
it's right here.
Right around there.
So, man, you know, traveling, flying will wear you out, man. It'll wear me out. And I've just, you know, I'm getting up to my story here, but traveling just wears me out. And what I find myself doing on these long flights is I watch some shows, if there's good shows. I watch foreign flicks. If I'm going to Azerbaijan or some foreign country, I'll try to pick some movies that are, you know, try to find an interesting movie in that. And it's kind of interesting, you know, watching a comedy from a foreign country, you know, and just trying to get their deal. But then I'll take a little sleeping pill and I'll sleep for 4 hours. Then I'm up, and what I find myself nerding out on a lot is a lot of these planes now have these interactive maps. So you're flying, you're kind of watching your jet trajectory going over these countries. And you know, and you start, I start zooming in and putting it on map mode. And just, that's where I find myself taking pictures of the screen. Like, hey, here's somewhere I might need to look at one day, the Amur River. I wonder what I was on it one day, you know. I really start exploring. And, you know, flying over Egypt and flying over the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea. And, you know, where I learned a lot of Western Civ, I probably took that course and showed up half the time. If I did, I don't know, because I don't remember a lot of it. But when I was in grad school at Mississippi State working for John Hodges there in the hardwood department, on the hardwood research project, we had a grad student, and I was kind of in charge of facilitating their programs, keeping them going. He had the largest graduate program in forestry, and a lot of the students were from this part of the world. And one of my one of the students was named Chetin. He was from Turkey. I met him during the O.J. Simpson trial, you know, and that was a pretty good conversation fodder for us to get to know each other. And he taught me a lot about the rise and fall of the Ottoman empires and politics. And I remember after 9/11, Rocky, not really understanding what was going on. Why would somebody do something like that? You know, and there was a fracas up at Mississippi State University because the whole world was talking about it the day after. That's all anybody was talking about. And there was a conversation on Engineering Alley in one of those math classes or something on Engineering Alley there at Mississippi State University. And somebody from the Middle East, and I heard this all second, third, and fourth hand, but it ain't that he may have said, oh, you deserve that. But he said, kind of shrugged and said, well, you know, given America's socioeconomic policy abroad, it bound to happen sooner or later. And man, he got a death broke over his head. And a lot of the Muslim community went underground for months. They disappeared. And I called to check on my friend Chetin, who I knew was Muslim, but he wasn't that kind of Muslim. He didn't get up and lay out a rug and pray to the east every morning and all that kind of stuff. He observed a lot of things. Some of the things he told me over the years as we visited, how he practiced, how just little things, little differences in things he observed in America versus Turkey. You know, the way he respected his father, the way he never looked his father in the eye, but because it was a sign of disrespect, or the way, you know, his wife was a beautiful woman and a great cook. Boy, she cooked good. And but you know, it was just a little real subtle differences in the way. But you know, I actually called Chetin after 9/11 to check on him, and it took a while. And because the only phone he had was there in the lab, and he was underground. And he was a very, it hadn't been for this guy. Let me tell you what, guy, I had written a 2,000 line algorithm in SAS for my own research, graduate research, and it wasn't running. And I had spent a week with that printed out algorithm trying to figure out why this thing wasn't running. I could write, by God, I could write SAS code back then, and I couldn't figure out why it was. I was absolutely, the time was clicking. I had to go. And I couldn't make this freaking thing run. And Chetin come in all calm one day and said, let me take it home and look at it. He brought back the next day and he said, you missed a comma. 2,000 lines of code and I missed a comma. and he found it. And I never would have found that, Rocky. I never in a million years would have found that comma. And he found it, just found it overnight reading it. And but I called him up, and he finally called me back, and we talked. I said, Chetan, you know, I don't understand, because you're Muslim and I'm Methodist, and we get along just fine. He was one of my favorite duck hunting buddies back in college, Rocky, because he would I loaned him a pair of waders, I loaned him a shotgun. He bought a license, he bought a stamp, he showed up on time. He was always the first one at the house, always. And he brought good coffee. His wife cooked really good blind food for us. And when all my buddies had classes and things to do after the hunt, yada, yada, Chetan, by God, sat right there on the porch with me, and we plucked ducks on the halves. And his wife would just turn them into masterpieces. And so I said, Chet, we get along great. What, explain to me what's going on. And, you know, in very simple terms, he explained, Ramsey, you know, boy, Rocky, I'm terrible with names, but it all goes back to the Bible. And he pointed to the one where, who was it, Rocky, whose wife, Sarah, could not conceive. And he had a son with the concubine. And then later, God granted Sarah the ability to bear children. And he had another son, Abraham. And he went right back to the story of Abraham. I want to say the name, but I didn't want to be wrong. And he went right to that story. He said, Ramsey, when that deception happened, he said, those two brothers became Zionism and Muslim, Islam. That's where it parted. And he says, there will never be reconciliation. He said, it's right there in your Bible. He said, the two will never reconcile. And he says, you know, and he said, but he explained to me also, he said, the reason you and I are friends, Ramsey, is because I'm just a regular Muslim, like many of your friends, because I had friends then that were in the graduate program that were from Pakistan and other places. And they were different people, but they were good people. You know, they came over here and got an education, and we got along. And he said, you know, but in every religion, to include ours, there's radicals. And these are zealots. They're radicals. They do not represent us. They represent their beliefs, and they're very zealous. And but, you know, it really took my friend Chetan from Turkey kind of explained that to me. In layman terms, I didn't understand. I'm a grown man. Heck, I was married, Forrest was born. I didn't understand what was going on, and why. You know, why? I would never dream in a million years of going and flying a plane into a building over in another country. Why? I couldn't understand. But it all started right here in this hub, not in Azerbaijan, but I would describe these people as Persians. I know in the city of Baku, which is, golly, what a beautiful city that is. The most beautiful airport in the world. That oil money, but it's a beautiful city, and it's right on the Caspian Sea, and the whole town just wraps around the Caspian Sea, and it's this beautiful boardwalk and incredible gardening and architecture, and then you get down to the old part of town, and the inner downtown is like I just imagine the walls of Jericho. Because it's like this adobe wall, and it's an old fort wall. There's a tower, and it's like 12 or 15 some odd hundred some odd years old. And you walk through those walls into that part of the town, and it's those old cobblestones that were laid back then. And it's kind of like Raiders of the Lost Ark adventure, because you know all the little vendors on the side of the sidewalk are selling, you know, Aladdin lamps and prayer rugs and things like that, you know, and it's just, wow, it's like stepping back in time. But then you step back out into the city, and there's all these concrete highway barriers wrapped around roads, and there's bleachers on the sides of the roads, and you say, well, what is that? Oh, that's where Formula 100, where Formula 1 comes and races. They got a 10-year contract in the city of Baku, and look, man, if Formula 1 is racing in your downtown, you're somebody, you know, and it's just insane. You know, and I love it. I tell you what, I get as much out of all that as I do But last year we had a few hours to kill before we went to the airport, and the flights are so late. What we do is we go to the hotel, take a nap, then go to the airport, because the flights don't leave out to about 2 or 3 in the morning. And we went to a Persian rug museum, and I'm like, oh boy, this is gonna suck. And it really didn't. It was kind of amazing to read why, you know, I don't know what you know about Persian rugs, but I mean, there's a million strands of thread running through those looms, and some little girl that learned to do it that her mama taught her, that her great grandmama taught her, that, I mean, that, you know, that's handed down like family tradition. They spend years weaving these very intricate details and pictures, and a lot of them are the story of their family. And they're really a big deal, like on the wedding day. It's a wedding rug that the family had made, spent years making, for this young lady to hang on her wall or put her on a special floor or something like that. And I spent an hour in there looking, and I thought it was kind of cool, you know, it tells you a lot about the people just learning about their culture, you know. And so I thought it kind of interesting. And just I walked into a when Jake comes in town, we're going to stop at this hunting store. Buddy, let me tell you, you ain't never seen a hunt store like this. I had never seen a hunt store like this. It was incredible. These people have got a profound hunting culture. So anyway, it's been a heck of a trip. We're right here where it all started. And, you know, last thing I was going to tell you, talking about the cradle of civilization, where it all started, Chetton. My good friend Chetton, the last time I actually saw him, we talked on the phone until he left and returned to Turkey. He actually became, by the way, I met him when he was a graduate student at Mississippi State University, got his PhD, and actually became a professor at Mississippi State University, and then came back to his homeland. Very, very smart guy, and very successful. But the last time I saw him, I had just written him an email after duck season. I was living in Brandon, and said something to the effect, you know, hey, if you need any ducks, you know, give me a shout, you know, 'cause I've got plenty after the season. Golly, I didn't say, well, you know, if you need some ducks, come knock on my door in 2.5 hours. But 2.5 hours later, I was eating supper, and he knocked on my door. So, hey, he said, I'm here for the ducks. I said, really? I just wrote you an email 2.5 hours ago. And I just meant, like, if you ever needed some, Chet, you know, but anyway, Chet gave me, got those ducks, and he had a proposal. He said, Ramsey, I want to take you duck hunting. I want to take you duck hunting in Turkey. And I've since learned foreign nationals can't hunt in Turkey. We would have. I was young, and I wasn't involved with all the stuff I'm involved with now. I probably would have not known any better. But he had set it up to where we were going to hunt with some government friends of his down in southwest Turkey, and we were going to hunt at the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. And it was one condition. He said, if you will come to Turkey, I will take you duck hunting for 2 or 3 days. All you have to do is buy your plane ticket. That was about $600 at the time. He said, I'll take care of everything else, but I want you to come for 1 week, 7 full days. I want to show you my country. You know, my understanding is Solomon's Gardens and a lot of that cool stuff is there in Turkey. And he wanted to show me his country, and I wanted to see it. And in the headlines at the time was David Pearl. If you remember him, the reporter that the jihadist cut his head off on YouTube. And this hunt was to take place about 250 miles from Syria. That's where that event happened. Chet, I don't know, buddy. I mean, I want to go shoot a duck. Trust you, man. I sure want to shoot a duck in the river system that Moses got floated down in a little reed basket. But, man, I don't know, you know. And he said, and he shook his head. He said, Ramsey, it's not like that. Not where we're going to be. Not with who we're going to be with. I promise you, it's just not like that. They're real people like me, like you. I want to show you my country. And we set it up. We said, okay, we're going to go. We picked a date. We're going to do this. We're going to do this next year. The year was 2010. I had this conversation with Chet. Next year, we're going to do this. Next November, we're going to do this. I'm going to fly to Turkey, take a week off from government to include weekends. It'll be 9 full days off. And I'm going to hunt in Turkey on the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates River. And 2 months, 2.5, 3 months preceding that trip, they flew those planes into the Trade Center. And Chetan's wife, who was pregnant at the time, Bianca, had actually gone home. And Chetan was unable to even go back home from the United States after that event. He could not even go home. He did not see his daughter until she was 2 years old. And she'd been born, was 2 years old before he made it back home. So that trip got side railed over all that mess. But you know, that's something I really would have liked to have done. And I still would like to go into that part of the world and hunt if it's ever safe and all to do so. But over here, it is safe. It's just as safe. These people are as friendly and as nice and as glad to meet us and see us and hear our stories. And remember, I told you, Rocky, one time, and I found this to be the truth this morning, again, in the boat, Ramis was, you know, got quiet. It was kind of got slow there for a while. And it wasn't a particularly fast hunt anyway. I was trying to pass on some birds. Just really, I was looking for those gorgonies. But we had some time in the boat. I broke out my cell phone and started showing him pictures. And it's just, you know, he got to see my family and my home and my ducks and my camp and you know, my way. And it clicked. It just absolutely clicked. And it's just, you know, and I see that time and time again. You know, we don't have to speak the same language. We get along, man, just duck hunting, hand signals and grunts and moans and funny sounds that I can say duck, he can say whatever duck is in Azerbaijan, we just get along fine. It we know what each other's saying. Boy, when you connect with those pictures, it just brings it all home. And they're just people. It's just the universal truth of duck hunting is people are people and duck hunters are duck hunters. And it's just I'll never get tired of experiencing new duck hunters around the world. It's one of the greatest rewards of my life. It's really and truly what I really get into and enjoy the most about this. And it's really what I hope that working with Jake on telling this story that we can really convey to everybody and just show people what it's like. You know, it's really not a big, scary world, Rocky. There's some bad people everywhere. There's some bad people 15 minutes from where I lay my head every night when I'm at home. But it really is a wonderful world of just good people and good duck hunters that, hey, if you don't mind being yelled at because he thinks you're a Lebanese duck hunter, every now and again, you turn it out, you learn something from him if you can just humble up and do it, you know.
I thought it was kind of interesting you brought up the Isaac and Ishmael. You know, I tell that to people all the time. Where did God told Isaac in the Bible that the descendants would be a thorn in the side of Isaac's descendants? And that's true. Yeah. Ishmael was a... Abraham didn't wait on God's promise. Well, who would sit around and wait? I mean, your wife's 90 years old. I don't mean to get too biblical, but you decide to go have one with your young, good-looking concubine, and it turns a world upside down. So it's kind of odd that you knew that.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, and it all goes back to being this part of the world. I mean, because I was sitting in Turkey the other day. I was sitting in, golly, I had a six-hour layover in Atlanta, and then a long flight and a six-hour layover in Istanbul. It just wasn't long enough. It wasn't a long enough layover to leave the Istanbul airport. Or I would have. You know, I had an eight-hour layover in Paris last year, and I got off that plane and walked straight to the exit gate, walked straight to the taxi cab, jumped in the back seat of a taxi, boom, went. Hey, he dropped me off down by the Eiffel Tower, and scared, you know, hey, look, man, I am kind of rushing it, you know, and I said, how much is that fare? And I don't remember what it was, $20. I said, here's $50. You're back here at 2:00. I'll give it to you. And let me tell you what, 1:55 p.m., that taxi cab driver come in on two wheels skidding. And I made my flight hand, so I got to go see downtown Paris for a little bit instead of sitting in an airport. I didn't have time to do that in Istanbul. And, but you know, while I was there, I had never been able to find Chet. I've been looking. I call myself looking on Facebook, and I'm not the savviest Facebook browser there is. I never could find him, but by God, I found his wife and reached out to her the other day and hope to hear back from him and touch base with him. You know, Rocky, you ever heard that? You ever moved? God, I hate moving. You know, moving houses is terrible. And especially when you get older and got a bunch of stuff. And we moved. We got married. My wife and I got married in Starkville. I worked there at university for 3 years. We moved to Grenada. Went to work Fish and Wildlife. Backed up a U-Haul. And, buddy, let me tell you what. You find out who your friends are. It's time to move. And old Chet and his wife showed up to help us move. We got down to just the absolute bare, I mean, just that last handful of stuff. All the back seats were full. All the front seats were full. All the trunks were full. The back of the U-Haul was full. And we still had just handfuls of stuff. And one of them things I had was a bobcat that I had shot in Alabama when I was a teenager. And I liked it. It was fine. But the taxidermist that had mounted it, it always threw me off because it had one eye had a round pupil and one eye had an elliptical pupil like a cat. So it always looked kind of funny, you know. And I gave that bobcat to Chet. And last I heard, he still had it. And I'd love to touch base with him and see if that bobcat ever made it over here to Turkey. I bet it. And I gave him a first big whitetail buck I ever shot. It wasn't big by day standards, but it was a big old 8-point, about 125 inches. And that was the other thing. I got the last two things. I didn't have nowhere to fit it. It just wouldn't fit nowhere to move the grenade, and I gave both to him. And he was proud as he could be of them. He'd always wanted it. And I'm just dying to know if I can reach out and touch base with him if he still got them. Anyway.
Well, Ramsey, I'm going to let you get to bed. I know it's late there. I appreciate you coming on and spending some time with us today. Thank you again. We want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line Podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.